I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Mersham,
Galen, Arlen, Bo, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtafer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. I'm getting over a bit of a cold, but I have a few new episodes coming out in the next few days, including this one, a conversation with returning guest, James Dorsey, a Middle East scholar and the man behind the Turbulent World with James M. Dorsey blog and Substack. He returns for what is becoming a regular update segment with him on the Gaza War. There are some problems with the audio on this one. There was a crackling sound I couldn't get rid of on James' side of the audio, but I highly recommend listening to this anyways, because James is just a font of knowledge and thoughtfulness. So with that in mind, let's get right to it with James Dorsey. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that has been recurring now for some time. He is one of the people I go to whenever I need an update on the Middle East. James M. Dorsey of the Turbulent World blog. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing good. The world seems to be a mess right now, especially with what we see continuing in Gaza. What do you think the most important points are?
That's an understatement.
Well, yeah. What do you think the most important points are right now with regards to the Gaza war?
Well, I think there are, first of all, I think it's important that you still have negotiations going on with regard to a ceasefire and a prisoner exchange. And in effect, the latest Hamas proposal, in some ways at least, paves the way to break the deadlock. That is to say that Hamas has returned to the original proposal that was made weeks ago in Paris when U.S., Qatari, and Egyptian negotiators met. That proposal was roughly a three-month ceasefire, the prisoner exchange being sort of spread out over that period, but it was not as such a permanent ceasefire. The idea was that in the second phase, so the second third of that ceasefire, if you wish, there would be negotiations about a permanent ceasefire. So that really allows both sides to save face to allow a process to go forward. Of course, there are the issues of the ratio of Palestinians and Israeli prisons to be released for hostages. But nonetheless, this is, I think, an important move. I think the second important move is, and we're seeing that today, despite what's happening in Gaza, that the Israelis have become more sensitive to international criticism, particularly from the United States, but not exclusively from the United States. So what that means is that you're seeing more aid go in. None of it is enough. None of it is quick enough. But nonetheless, more aid is going in. And you're seeing the Israelis trying to fight their information war somewhat better with, for example, the attack that is ongoing at this moment on the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza. And I think the third thing is here that if indeed there is a ceasefire, then that would be one reason why the Israelis would want to hit Rafah sooner rather than later. Because obviously that won't be an option in a ceasefire. And there is a risk that Israelis will be forced into a permanent ceasefire. Then, of course, there's no operation in Rafah either. Now, the importance of Rafah is that the Israelis presumably believe that Hamas's top leadership is in Rafah. And let's keep in mind that the Israelis in now the sixth month of the war have yet to wipe out even one member of the top member leadership in Gaza of Hamas. Israel has yet to achieve its war goals. What is clear is that they have not destroyed Hamas. They have not liberated the hostages. And Hamas, you know, Gaza is probably going to be a security problem for years to come. Now, let me just make one side note on what's happening today. In the reporting by, let's say, a source that is most favorable towards the Palestinians, Al Jazeera, there is talk of significant fighting. So witnesses that they interview from within the Al-Shifa Hospital talk about significant fighting at the gate of the hospital. Now, Jazeera has not made clear who that fighting is between, but I think it's a fair assumption to make that armed Palestinian resistance fighters clearly are the ones on the opposite side of the Israelis, which really then changes the narrative about Al-Shifa Hospital and the narrative potentially about other hospitals, which is not to justify the attacks on the hospitals, but to try and get our facts straight.
I'm curious, what do you make of the recent sensitivity that you mentioned earlier that Israel has to criticism? Because I think we've gone much farther now than just... It's one thing to criticize Israel. I don't even see Democrats like Joe Biden or Chuck Schumer criticizing Israel. What I see them doing is criticizing Netanyahu. And it just seems a little bit wild to me that that's being called anti-Israel now, to criticize Netanyahu by magazines like Commentary. Elliot Abrams at the CFR recently said some wild things in regards to Schumer's comments. What do you make of this?
Well, first of all, the Israelis have been very successful, to their credit, in identifying criticism of Israel or criticism of Zionism with anti-Semitism. I mean, that's essentially like saying you can't criticize a sub-Saharan African state because that would be anti-black racism. It's nonsensical. But the Israelis have done that extremely well. And I think they've done their own democracy. They've done democracy in Europe, in the United States, on issues of freedom of expression. They've done them a disservice. Criticism is healthy. Now, to be fair, the lines between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are at times blurred, which really means that those that are critical of Israel or
they need
of
to take mind of that,
or of anti-Semitism need to be very clear in what their criticism is so that it cannot be misunderstood.
But I guess it seems like we've gone further than it used to be that, you know, criticizing Israel would get some people labeling you anti-Semitic. Now, I mean, even if a Democrat says, you know, Netanyahu is not the best candidate for Israel, or is not the best prime minister, now that's getting, I mean, maybe it's always been that way, but it just seems like very extreme to say that you can't even criticize the prime minister now. I mean, I don't know.
No, it's extreme. It's undemocratic. And the problem with it is that many politicians, institutions, individuals have fallen into the trap.
Right. I want to ask you, on the Palestinian side of things, what do you think people don't understand about their perspective? I'm not asking you to be polemical about it to do some defense, but I think sometimes people don't know that perspective. What do you think people miss about the Palestinian perspective on, you know, just the history even before October 7th and the current war?
Look, I think there's no question about it. Okay, there's not an easy answer to the question, and part of the problem in terms of explaining the Palestinian issue is that it's very difficult to explain the Jewish issue. You know, so we get all of these terms being thrown around, colonialism, settlers, what have you. And Israel has aspects of those. But Israel is not your classical colonial power, and it's not your classical settler-ish problem. So in other words, Jewish identity is in a category of its own. It can be national, it can be religious, and it can be neither. And coming to grips with that is important in terms of understanding the whole Zionist enterprise. Now, is that a legitimacy to disenfranchise another people? Of course it's not. Having said that, the facts of the matter are Israel exists. And Israelis have their own identity, which is separate from Jews. And if the Gaza war has done anything, it's different. The differentiation between a Jewish identity and an Israeli identity has become much starker in the last 6 months. Now, the problem is that whatever settlement you get is going to be a bad settlement, whether that's one state, which will probably end up in civil war.
You mean a bad settlement for both, do you think, for both Palestinians and
both
Israelis?
Parties.
Okay.
For both parties. And the idea that the two-state solution, which is probably the best of bad solutions, that's, once you've established a state, that's the panacea, and the Israeli-Palestinian relations are going to be lovey-dovey ever going forward. Just look at India and Pakistan. It's going to be a troubled relationship. But in any case, it does cater to Palestinian aspirations and Palestinian rights, which takes me to the last point on this, I just had someone comment on my last article, and the comment was, they're all victims of Hamas. Fact of the matter is, Israelis and Palestinians are victims of Israel and Hamas, certainly in this war. And unless
there
we start...
By the way, not to interrupt you, but there does seem to be divisions now between Hamas and, on the other end, Fatah. I mean, those divisions are kind of coming to the fore. I see more media coverage of it.
The divisions have been there for the last 18 years.
Right. It's getting reported on more now, but yeah.
So that's not. But I think that two things. One is, I think that unless we start applying one yardstick to all sides, we're going to have a problem. So, is Hamas a culprit? Without question. Is Hamas disregardful of the lives of Palestinians for its own political purposes? No doubt. But the same is true for Israelis. And as the UN Secretary General controversially said some time ago, October 7 didn't happen in a vacuum. Israeli policy has been, throughout the years, a policy of occupation in the West Bank, and a policy of denial and trying to prevent any pathway to fulfilling Palestinian aspirations alongside Israel rather than instead of Israel.
I'm curious, are you familiar with, there's a lawyer that I've spoken to, she's a Palestinian, I believe Palestinian-American lawyer, Saha Hassan, and she, along with, I believe, Daniel Levy, argued that, you know, the best way forward for a lot of things in regards to Israel-Palestine is the U.S. needs to take more of a human rights-centric approach rather than focusing on trying to get the two-state solution to happen. Do you think that's on point, or do you think there's problems with that?
Well, as a matter of principle, absolutely yes. But I think it's also an issue of taking a step back, and that's true for everybody, and looking at what is real and what is not real. So you mentioned you mentioned the division between Hamas and Fatah. Beyond the fact that it's a pure political power struggle, it's also about an issue of principle, in which Hamas is basically the Israeli demand in any negotiation, irrespective of who is on the other side of the table, is you have to first recognize the state, and you have to abandon and denounce armed struggle. Those are the two Palestinian trump cards. What happened in Oslo is that the Palestinians were willing to do that. You know, so the 1993 Oslo Accords. We're now 31 years further. And it's been a strategy or a tactic that has failed. And that's what Hamas says very clearly. So that's one reason why. Now, I think that if you read between the lines and you're seeing a very similar process in my mind that you saw in the PLO in the period from 1974 until 1988, which was when Yasser Arafat recognized Israel and denounced violence. You're seeing that same process going forward in within Hamas, and the jury is out where it will come out, but you're seeing that process. If you look at the latest division, if you wish, between Hamas and Fatah, and what you're referring to is that the Palestine Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, the president, appointed a prime minister. Hamas denounced that, and Fatah responded to that.
I think Hamas said you should be going to us before you make decisions or something along those lines.
Well, the deal, okay, where does that come from? That comes from the fact that what is being negotiated or mediated between Hamas and Fatah and the Palestine Authority is that and Hamas would join the PLO. In doing so, it would implicitly recognize agreements that were accepted by the Palestine Authority, which include recognition of Israel, denunciation of... At the same time, and this is what the appointment of the new prime minister was supposed to do, is create the basis for the creation of a technocratic government that once the war in Gaza is over, would take over from the Israelis, from Hamas, whatever it may be. And that Hamas would support that government, but not be represented in that government. So, if you want to be realistic about trying to create a solution, this is the way forward. Now, the Israelis want to block that because they understand that the return of the Palestine Authority with a technocratic government or not that rules both Gaza and the West Bank is a step towards a Palestinian state.
Is that viewed then by Israel as a security threat? Or
look, there's always going to be a security threat. But again, one has to measure with one yardstick. Palestinian armed groups are a security threat to Israel. Israel is a security threat to Israel, to Palestinians. And that's the equilibrium that you've got to recognize and address on both sides. It's not that Israel doesn't have legitimate security needs. It's that Israel says, my security needs dominate anything else. Doesn't matter what.
I wanted to ask you a question that I get from the pro-Israel side of things a lot. I've gotten some nasty emails over the course of not just the past few months, but in the past.
I have no doubt.
One thing that I always hear from a lot of very fervent pro-Israel voices, and I do think there's different types of pro-Israel voices, but the most fervent ones will say to me, what you don't understand is that the Arabs lost in 48 and we took their land because they lost. And that's just the way it is. They should just surrender. Ugh. How are we supposed to respond to that? I guess. So I think that's,
Look, first of all, there was a UN partition plan. Now, to be fair, the Arabs did lose the war in 48. And Israel ended up being proclaimed with control of more land than the UN partition plan envisioned. And the world acquiesced in that. They recognized Israel within the borders of 1948. And they essentially welcomed Israel in the United Nations, in the family of nations, within its 1948 borders. The border issue was not really an issue until 1967, when Israel conquered land. And so the fact of the matter is that, sure, you can make that argument. It doesn't get you anywhere. And it certainly does not ensure your security. And everything since 1948 demonstrates that.
I also wanted to ask you, could you go back to that issue of, Hamas hasn't been, well, both Hamas and Israel have been bad for Palestinians. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Look, Palestinians lack good leadership, period. whether that's Hamas or whether that's Fatah. The fact of the matter is that Israel, backed by the United States, with a caveat, by the way, never wanted to deal with Hamas. And so what happened in 2006, 2007, roughly, when Hamas took control of Gaza and basically threw Fatah out after the elections, in which Hamas came out as a victor, that was in part international Palestinian fighting, but it was in part the Israelis wanting to undermine Hamas from day one. Now, there are two caveats on that. One caveat is that even if the Americans supported Israel in its rejection of Hamas, they also wanted to keep a channel open, which is why Hamas is in Qatar, and which is why Qatar welcomed Hamas. And you also had a number of informal sort of track two, track 1.5, with other words, not officials, but former officials, engaged in a dialogue with Hamas at the behest of the administration. So I think, you know, that in itself tells you a lot. But the other part of it, of course, is that Qatari funding of Hamas, or Hamas government employees, and investment in Gaza was at the behest of the Israelis, particularly at the behest of Netanyahu, because Netanyahu wanted to keep Palestinians divided. So on the one hand, he maintained the siege of Gaza now for 17, 18 years. But on the other hand, he made sure that there was just enough going in, with Israel controlling anything and everyone that goes in. But he also wanted to ensure that Hamas remains in power there, and believed that that Israel could contain Hamas.
And in doing it, so, split the Palestinians, right?
And keep it, you know, as a wedge between the Palestinians. And that's what phenomenally backfired on October 7th.
If you could, you wrote a piece recently entitled "Weaponizing Food, Palestinians Lose Lives, Israelis Lose Humanity." Could you just give the overview of that piece?
Well, the basic argument was that the Israelis had weaponized food. I mean, they did that from day one. Let's face it, resolving the food crisis in Gaza can be done overnight. All you have to do is open the border crossings. On the Egyptian side at Rafah, the trucks are sitting there. Instead of waiting 2 months till you build a pier in Gaza, you could ship it to Ashdod. And that's, you know, a jump away from Gaza. Just truck it down. So the Israelis very clearly have used starvation as a weapon. And as far as I'm concerned, with devastating consequences for Gaza and for Gazans, and particularly Gazan children. And as far as I'm concerned, that's unconscionable. Nothing justifies that.
Yeah, we're talking about a people that are very much stuck in the middle. I mean, you know, before October 7th, there were protests against Hamas that were well known in Gaza. And they're caught dealing with, Gazans are caught having to deal with Hamas and also having to deal with Israel. You know, they're the biggest losers in all of this.
Well, the problem, look, let's put it this way, that ultimately the jury is out on whether Hamas is going, or how popular Hamas is going to be in Gaza over time. Clearly, there's no room for protests at the moment. And there was criticism of Hamas prior to October 7, without question. Hamas, of course, thrives on the fact, on two things. One is the alternative Palestinian, or the Palestinian alternative at this moment, is a corrupt and ineffectual Palestine Authority that is largely seen as doing the Israelis' bidding. So you have a Palestine Authority that has, you know, basically believes in the justification of the resistance against the Israelis, yet doesn't stand up for them when the Israelis intervene. Now, to be fair, the Palestine Security Force would be crushed in any confrontation with the Israelis. But nonetheless, and you have, on the other hand, Hamas in Gaza, which, brutally and shot itself in its own leg in the way that it conducted the October 7 attack on Israel. But most Palestinians, even if they're critical of the way that October 7 was conducted and the killing of large numbers of civilians and the brutality at times in that killing, would justify the act as such, the right, certainly, and would have had much less problems if Hamas would have concentrated exclusively on Israeli military targets when it breached Israeli defenses on October 7. I think, and the problem, of course, is that what Israel's trying to do with reaching out to tribes and clan leaders, a lot of these guys are thugs too. Basically, they're the equivalent of armed gangs, which isn't a recipe for restoration of law and order in Gaza either.
Just a few more things here. Where do you think the ultra-nationalist and ultra-religious right in Israel is headed? And where do you see the Netanyahu government headed? Because, I feel like this is like the last stand for Netanyahu, but I don't know where things are going to end up.
Well, let's divide things up. First of all, you look at it on paper and logic is this is the beginning of the end of Netanyahu, and the war is basically postponement of execution. But keep in mind, Netanyahu is a cat with nine lives. He's a very smart politician in a polarized political environment. And so I wouldn't write him totally off. The second thing I would caution about is that the alternatives for Netanyahu today, whether that's Benny Gantz or Gallant, the defense minister, they don't have the sharp edges of the ultra-nationalists and the ultra-conservative. But fundamentally, they're not going to be all that much easier to deal with. So, it's not going to be smooth sailing once, if and when Netanyahu leaves office. With regard to the ultra-conservatives and ultra-nationalists, they did very well in recent municipal elections.
I thought that was very interesting because the logic that I kept hearing was that October 7th was going to be the blow that killed the ultra-nationalists, the Ben-Gvir types. But it seems like that's, if those elections are any indication, that's not the case.
Right. Now, I think you've got to be cautious with drawing conclusions of the municipal elections for what may or may not happen in a national election. And in the polls, if one is to believe the polls, this coalition would lose. It would not have a majority in parliament. It would not be forming the next government. So there is that distinction. I think one of the issues, of course, is that you have a growing ultra-conservative portion of the population that is increasing in terms of its percentage of the population. And those are the people that may or may not vote for the ultra-conservatives and the ultra-nationalists. Interestingly enough, I mean, you have the issue, and that's a long-standing issue that precedes the Gaza war. Or you have the issue of military service. And interestingly enough, in recent days, the chief rabbi, the chief Sephardi rabbi of Israel said, if you're not going to exempt us from military service, we'll just pack up and leave the country.
There was another rabbi that you mentioned recently, Rabbi Mali, or Mali.
Eliyahu Mali.
What happened Eliyahu. With him? I mean, he basically was inciting. Well, you can explain.
Well, he runs a yeshiva, basically a religious seminary, if you wish, the Jewish equivalent of a madrasa, in Jaffa, which is the originally Palestinian part of Tel Aviv. And it's now a mixed neighborhood. He moved in with his yeshiva into Jaffa some years ago, essentially to try and turn Jaffa into a totally Jewish neighborhood. And he recently, about a week, maybe 2 weeks ago, was at a seminar in his yeshiva in Jaffa, in which he justified the killing of men. He justified the killing of children in Gaza because they were the future. They were the terrorists of tomorrow. He justified the killing of women because they were the ones who brought terrorists to the world. Now, he didn't use the word genocide, but essentially that's what it came down to. And, you know, to me at least, the tragedy is that that was not, those were not statements that members of the Israeli government took distance to.
In terms of Joe Biden, where do you think he's caught in all of this? Because I feel like he doesn't really know what to do next. And I think he wrote about this in that piece. Biden may not have enough rope to push his vision of the Middle East.
Well, okay. There are two things here. What I was saying in that piece is that Biden's vision for the Middle East is not a vision that he's going to be able to realize prior to the election. And so whether that vision really holds is going to depend on who wins the U.S. election. And one of the things that I was arguing, since the Saudis are part of that vision, in terms of a broad deal, one leg of that deal would be Saudi recognition of Israel. The Saudis are interested in that deal, and therefore interested to get it done before the U.S. elections, in the case that Biden would not be reelected. So that's one part of this equation. The other part is that I think that Biden clearly has a great empathy for Israel, and is supportive of Israel. But I think that there are two issues. He could have been supportive with Israel, but at the same time being more empathetic towards the Palestinians. It's very recent that that he's shown any empathy for Palestinians. And of course, the tone sets the music, if you wish. So I think that's one problem. But the other problem is that the simplistic view is that Biden just needs to pick up the phone and say to Netanyahu, it stops today, period. And there's evidence for that. That happened in 2021. That's how the then Gaza war was ended. It's happened going back to Eisenhower in 1956. It doesn't mean that that's what would happen today if Biden were to pick up the phone. It's a function of two things, essentially. One is degree of dependency on the United States and the politics at that moment. So the politics today in Israel are very different to the politics in 2021. And in the extension of that, so, you know, Netanyahu is fighting for his political life. He has a cabinet that in which the far right makes or breaks the government. So he may very well say to Biden, if Biden were to make the phone call, no way, Jose, forget it.
Yeah, because if he enrages that far right, they can leave the coalition, right?
Sure, but he won't be able to form a coalition again.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that's one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is that Israel is less dependent on the United States than it has been in the past. So, for example, in 1981, U.S. support of Israel accounted for 10% of Israeli GDP. Today, it accounts for 1%. When we're talking about weaponry, Israel buys a lot of its highly sophisticated, most sophisticated weaponry from the United States. F-35s. F-35s are not what Israel needs in Gaza. Granted, Israel buys ammunition from the United States, but it buys it from the United States because it's quicker and cheaper, not because it doesn't have the infrastructure to manufacture it. You know, Israel has a very sophisticated arms industry in which it can, it's a major arms exporter, in which it can produce a lot of what it needs. You know, M16s, you can replace those today. So, you know, I think, you know, that's another reality that Biden has to deal with, that you know, that leverage may not be what it seems to be. And that's not so much a question of, you know, I would be careful with drawing from that the conclusion that U.S. power has diminished. Of course, U.S. power has diminished. But this is more an equation of the balances between Israel and the United States over time having changed.
Before closing out, how do you think Saudi Arabia, UAE, and other states in the Gulf, and just the Arab world in general, how do they fit into things right now? Because it seems like the more this war drags on, I feel like no one knows what to do about it at this point. I think there's a lot of chaos at play.
Well, and I don't think it's so much what to do about it.
Yeah.
It's what you can do about it.
Right, right.
You know, and the Qataris are probably doing they're actually doing something. They're mediating, and they're in a position to mediate that very few others are. Certainly not the Emiratis, and certainly not the Saudis. I think that the Emiratis and the Saudis would have liked to have seen Hamas's demise, but are taken aback by what is happening in Gaza. And even if they weren't taken aback, have to be taken aback because of popular sentiment. But there's very little they can do. I mean, interestingly enough, I mean, obviously what it's done on the Saudi side is it's raised the bar for a Biden deal. It can no longer can be a fig leaf for the Palestinians. The Emiratis, Bahrain have been less explicit about it, but nonetheless, the proof is in the pudding. The Emiratis have been very clear that they would not want to break off diplomatic relations with Israel, despite their condemnations of Israel's conduct of the war And they've gone a step further last week by suspending a $2 billion oil and gas deal primarily with Israel. And that sends a signal. But beyond that, there's really not a lot that they can do. I mean, sure, they can break off relations with the Emiratis and the Bahrainis, the Moroccans can break off relations with Israel, and it would be a blow. But is that going to be what fundamentally persuades persuades Netanyahu's top of the war? Probably not.
I also wanted to ask you briefly here. You know, I spoke with Ian Lustig a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, and he was really convinced that like the war was going to wrap up because the U.S. was going to intervene and say what Biden said in the 2021 war, which you have to stop and wrap it up. That hasn't happened. So, and I think it hasn't happened for reasons you said. Netanyahu feels like, you know, at this point, he can't stop the war. It could destroy his coalition if he does, et cetera. So how long could this drag on, in your opinion?
Look, let me put it this way. 3 months are a long time. So, if indeed you got an agreement on a ceasefire that would have two or three phases, and of which the dynamic is to come to an end to the war, you know, that's one way of doing it, and that may be the way of doing it, because the phone call may not work. Sure, you've seen the Israelis. The Israelis increase humanitarian aid, wanting to be seen to be doing that. And that is as much a result of pressure, particularly U.S. pressure and European pressure. But it's also a result that it's dawning on the Israelis that they have lost the information war. And that the consequences, short, medium, and long term, are going to be significant. And so, you know, I think the best bet at this point to try and, one, get the guns to fall silent for a period of time, but also to get at an end to the war is the proposal that's on the table now. And I think Netanyahu understands that.
Real quick, I wanted to go back to, you mentioned these Gazan clansmen. Could you delve into that a bit more? And how they figure into everything, and then we'll leave it at that.
Sure. Essentially, you have very powerful families in Gaza, clans, and they have often been at odds with political authority.
They're sort of like almost like organized crime, basically.
They're like warlords, basically.
Okay.
Certainly now. And they've clashed with Hamas in the past prior to the war.
There was one you mentioned in particular that
they're very Dumash. Powerful.
Yeah.
You have, for example, and I mentioned that in a story of mine, the Dohmush clan, which was involved in the 2007 kidnapping of a British journalist, was involved in the kidnapping in, I think, 2005, of Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was exchanged in 2011 for more than 1,000 Palestinians in Israeli prison. Hamas has accused the clan of stealing humanitarian aid. They've been involved in the arms trade and various other things. And their lead, now, those are the people that the Israelis, if they're going to use Palestinians, there are other ideas floating around, to secure the flow of trucks into Gaza without relying on the Hamas police force that the Israelis would like to engage with. Now, the leader, one of the clan leaders and two others were killed last week in their family compound. It's not clear who killed them, but my suspicion is that this is Hamas trying to send a message very clearly to the Klan's leaders that cooperation with Israel is a red line and trying to thwart the Israeli effort.
But as you point out, too, even if these Klans survive, I mean, they're not... I mean, it's gambling for Israel to work with these Klans. They're not exactly, you know, they have their own sort of agendas. And I mean, as you said, they're kind of thugs.
Right, sure. But to be fair, it's a strategy that has worked to degrees in other places. Southeastern Turkey, for example, with the village guards. I mean, this is not a strategy that's going to work with a Hamas that survives the Gaza war. And with the difference, of course, with Turkey was that there was no concerted effort to solve the Kurdish problem in Turkey. There is a concerted effort, for whatever that effort is worth, to resolve the Palestinian problem.
Is there anything I missed in the course of this conversation that you think it's really important for my listeners to take in right now about the Gaza war?
No, I think we've covered it fairly thoroughly.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. How can my listeners keep up with your work? You're on Substack. Do you want to just give out your links?
Yes, I would. Well, you can subscribe on Substack, and the address is www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com. So www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com. There's a free subscription, but I'm trying to cover the cost of my twice weekly column and podcast. And so if people are willing to support that, a paid subscription would be more than welcome.
Thank you again, James M. Dorsey, for coming back on Parallax Views.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with James Dorsey. I know, as I said at the beginning of the show, there were some audio issues that I couldn't eradicate, but I hope you were able to enjoy the conversation anyways, especially with that disclaimer there. Maybe it, you know, didn't hurt your expectations of what you would hear, and that maybe helped you in some way get through it. I don't know, but you can't always fix some of the audio in post. I still was able to drown it out and hear everything that James was saying. In any case, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.